Authentic Wellness Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 49 of Authentic Wellness Radio. And today, talking to us about addictions, impulses, breaking the cycle of bad habits, we've got Dr. Herbie Bell, founder of Recovery Healthcare, a doctor of chiropractic medicine, and a man who has 30 years' experience in this area, and who wanted to come on today and share with you all a different way to think about the way that we do things. He was also the host of Sober Conversations podcast, and he's joining me on the line right now. Dr. Bell, how are you?
I'm doing really, really very well, Dave. Thank you for this distinct pleasure and honor.
Hey, thank you for joining me. Now, usually when I'm going through someone's bio, I can pretty much read what's going on. Like, I can see RN and know that. So, registered nurse or registered nutritionist or whatever. But there's one on your bio that got me, and that's DACACDC. What does that stand for?
I like that. Alphabet soup, right? Well, you know, yeah. DC stands for dog catcher.
Yeah, I had that one written down. I actually missed that part of your intro.
And of course, MD stands for mad dog. So we got to get that squared away, first of all. But can I also add that not on my CV is that I am a closeted Australian.
Are you really?
I am, for years and years, I've been saying, how you going? And people still in this culture wince and say, what are you talking about? Just from going to, you know, we'll say, how you doing? And I love to say, how you going? Plus, we must say something about AC/DC.
Yes. Is that what that actually means? Because it's all D.
No. Okay, you want me to answer the question? Here it is. DACACD stands for Diplomate, the American College of Addiction and Compulsive Disorders, candidate status.
Right, okay. There you go. I've never seen that one before. And there was another one, actually, FASBE. What's a FASB?
A FASB is a fellow of the American College of Biomechanical Engineering. So it's an interesting tack I've taken to work in addiction medicine. But, we have come to the conclusion that it's all about mind, body, spirit approach. And that's why it is so relevant that this conversation is so relevant, because that's where everything's going, from wellness to healthcare in general.
I do love the way you talk about all three of those. But what I thought we could start out with in a conversation about addiction and bad habits and impulses and whatnot is that that kind of stuff doesn't necessarily always apply to what we would think about with drugs or food or alcohol or anything like that. So how would you define what it is what we're going to be talking about today, and who do you think it affects, and more importantly, who do you think can learn from the strategies that we'll be talking about later as well?
Well, you know, there are all kinds of estimates who is susceptible to these kinds of addictive tendencies, but it is such a continuum, you know, from being addicted to Doritos to being addicted to methamphetamine. And I think that everybody can benefit from this conversation and understanding and trying to empathize personally. One out of three of our families in America, anyway, has an addiction issue. So it's a huge, huge public health challenge. And as you and I talked about a little bit prior to our live conversation, I'd kind of like to move back to what wholeness is, and then we can discuss what addiction is, which is basically just a separation from the wholeness. Got some simple definitions for addiction if you, once we get there as well.
Now, who do you think should be learning about or from you with regards to this kind of stuff? Because the process of recovering from addiction, you could say that's changing the way that you live or doing things differently, even though that's quite challenging. And that's the same process that people go through to get healthy as well, whether it's not staying up so late at night to watch their favorite TV show and missing sleep and waking up tired or skipping exercise or whatever. Do you see a correlation between trying to get healthy and trying to break through the cycle of addiction?
Seamless correlation, seamless, S-E-A-M. And that, you know, I discovered through my addiction recovery that I didn't know how to eat, move, think, feel, and sleep well by virtue of what the culture taught me. I'm not victimized by it, but the culture produces addiction. People with addiction don't choose to be, to contract addiction.
No, absolutely. It's not a choice, and it's not something that someone gets or anything like that. But How would you go about identifying if someone may have addictive impulses or behaviors that aren't necessarily serving them anymore? I mean, for me, if I had to answer that question, I'd say, what do you think you can't live without? Like, if you were dropped on a desert island, what would you miss you most? Whether it's your phone or your children or chocolate or whatever it might be. That's what I would say someone is kind of stuck with if they can't live without it. Where would you go for that answer?
Well, certainly that would be a clue. And so here's a simple definition of addiction, and it has three parameters. The first is that there is an increased craving for whatever the behavior or the substance is, and an increased seeking. You notice that I'm preoccupied by thought. I want to seek this behavior or substance more than you used to. The second parameter is a loss of control. So when you start doing the behavior or the substance, you use more than you would ordinarily, and you just don't have any control whether or not you're going to use it. And then the third parameter is you continue doing the behavior regardless of negative consequences. And that can be, you know, bet you can't eat just one. We've all eaten a pint of ice cream one night and the next morning saying, I swore I would never do that again. And then the far end of the spectrum is the man or woman who has three driving while intoxicated violations and then decides to go out and do it again and kills four people on the freeway. So you can find yourself anywhere on that continuum. Loss or increased cravings, loss of control, and continued behavior with even with negative consequences.
Now, on the less serious side of the scale, even if someone, let's say, couldn't control their impulses and ate something at a party that they knew they couldn't eat that would make them feel bad, or, you know, let's say they had gluten or maybe not alcohol, but something that they knew that they've eaten that wouldn't make them feel particularly good, can they use the kind of same tools that someone recovering from the process of addiction could use to tackle that and get better, I don't want to say control, but better mastery over their actions and habits around that?
Well, I know it's true for me, and I know it's true for the people that I work with, and I'm sure that you know, as the gifted practitioner you are with the CHECK protocol, et cetera, absolutely. We use, you know, the brain is rewritable, and repetition is the mother of all invention, right, Dave?
Yes, it is, absolutely. Now, let's flip this around. How does someone view themselves if they're relating to what you're talking about? Maybe it's eating ice cream at night or soft drink or coffee or whatever. Is someone supposed to look at themselves in the mirror and see themselves as an addict? Obviously, the answer to that is no. But you and I were talking off the show and saying, like, if someone has a heart attack, that doesn't necessarily define them for the rest of their life. But if someone is an addict, then we kind of label them. We don't call people who've had heart attacks heart attack victims, but we would call someone who's suffering from addiction an addict. So how should someone view themselves if they can relate to this kind of behavior that we're talking about now?
Well, I would say as, you know, a departure from equanimity or balance or wholeness or health, instead of using those, as we were calling, subjugated terms like addict or alcoholic or food addict or whatever it is, because those terms have become passé and outdated. And you know, if I introduce myself in a room anymore outside of recovery circles as, hi, I'm Herbie, I'm an addict or a drug addict, you know, people don't understand that. They think, well, what's he going to do, pull out a needle and stick it in his head? So, you know, paying attention to mind, body, spirit on a regular basis, checking in every single day, you know, how is my body? How is my mind or my intellect? How is my emotional domain? How is my spiritual domain? Whatever that looks for you, is just a part of the process of being a healthy human being.
Now, you're someone who has firsthand experience in this area. How do you talk about it, and what does it sound like when you reflect back on that?
Say that another way, Dave.
So you have struggled with addiction in the past, and you've moved past that, and you have. You've been doing this for 30 years now, so you've been around the traps when it comes to addiction for quite a while. When you're talking about your own previous experiences as someone who's struggled with that How do you refer to that point in your life, and how do you, what's your perspective on yourself there? Do you call yourself, like, do you call yourself an addict, or do you say, I struggled with addiction, or that's something that I'm likely to fall prey to, or how do you think about that?
Well, I like that. How do I think about that? What was that colloquialism you used? You've been around the traps?
Yeah. That's an Australian term as well.
What are traps?
I actually don't know. I think it's like a dog racing word. I think a trap is where you put a dog before it goes and does racing on a track. So I think it's like one of those terms.
I love that. So I'm going to be saying that from now until eternity. Thank you.
I think you should.
Here's the way it goes. There are five risk factors for addiction. Are you familiar with them?
Not at all.
So, and these are they. The first is a genetic predisposition. And we just know this is so. Now, we don't all have to go off and get an expensive genetic sequencing test. But if you've got family members who have had problems with addiction, that's a red flag. Just look and say, yeah, I'm probably predisposed to promoting and initiating this condition with that in my history. The second thing is childhood trauma. And that would be if there's any emotional, physical, sexual, spiritual trauma. Did you see the Academy Awards?
I did not. I heard most of the results, but I didn't see it.
And, you know, a film that won was called Spotlight.
Oh, everyone, you know what? Three of my clients told me to watch that yesterday.
And so what it's about is the Catholic Church's involvement in this sexual and spiritual abuse for children. So most of these people developed addiction. Point is that if you have childhood trauma in your past, it's just a red flag as well, something to look at. The third thing is when people start using the behavior, the age they started. I started drinking alcohol and using cigarettes when I was 13 years old. So that doesn't bode well with the other risk factors. The fourth has to do with your family or social environment. And that means, did you grow up in a family that is practicing these behaviors because everybody does it? Does that make sense to you?
Yep.
Risk factor. And then the fifth is a psychological, or we'll call psychiatric overlay, if you've got depression, anxiety, ADHD, those kinds of things. Those folks are more inclined, or people with those conditions are more inclined to develop addiction. And so I had all five of those risk factors in my family. My father was a double board certified medical physician, board certified in internal medicine and psychiatry. And he was also a man with addiction and commit suicide. He died of addiction through suicide when I was 9 years old. And five other suicides in my family associated with addiction and compulsive disorders. So there, that's sort of a profound way of saying, yes, indeed, family history has a lot to do with it. I was an accident waiting to happen. In those years, we didn't know what we know now, and the rest is history. And so now I tell people, know these things. Talk to your family about these things. Look into each of them, because each of those things needs to be looked at in addiction recovery after the fact.
Absolutely. Now, when you talk about addiction recovery, you mentioned that it's like a three-legged stool. You say you've got to move well, you have to eat well, and you have to think well. Now, since you're a chiropractor and I'm a physical therapy student and a Czech practitioner, let's talk about moving well. And you say that lack of movement is a trigger for relapses. The body looks to release stress in some particular way. Now, we all know that exercise relieves stress, but going back to our addictive behaviors can also relieve stress as well. So how do you see the link between these two, and how can someone use exercise to give their body what it's looking for in a different way to the substance that might be causing the issue?
And what a beautiful thing. Movement and exercise is now, you know, being rediscovered as the, it drives me crazy when I hear other disciplines call it the miracle drug. But in fact, we are hunters and gatherers. I'm interested in ancestral health principles. We've been walking for 2.6 million years. And so it is built into our genetic blueprint that the brain needs stimulation through bodily movement. And we're learning much more about that as well. Less is more. We don't have to go to the gym and become Arnold Schwarzenegger. Just doing something every day is stimulation for the brain. The brain needs oxygen, fuel, and stimulation in the way of cognitive stimulation and physical stimulation through bodily movement. So everybody's got to find out what works for them. I say the best exercise, you might say the same thing, is the kind you'll do, right?
Absolutely.
But we got to move as human beings to the degree that we can. It's all relative. Everybody does it a different way, and there are some basic guidelines.
Now, you talk a lot about the good the good neurotransmitters that we need in our brains. So things like 5-HTP, which people know as serotonin, or dopamine, or whatever. But people don't always understand that these kinds of things are moved throughout the body by movement. So it's common that people know that middle-aged men quite often die of heart attacks, but it's not because of nutrition always. It's because they don't exercise enough, and the muscular system is supposed to do the job of the heart in that it helps move things like nutrients and whatnot around the body. And when we breathe properly as well, that's how the brain gets circulation as well. That's how we move cerebral spinal fluid through. So if we have something like these good neurotransmitters that are made in our digestive system, but we're not exercising, then the body's not able to move it around because the heart itself can't do that job. So what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think you're just speaking to the holistic nature of things. I also love when people ask whether it's a holistic approach. And, you know, my response is everything is holistic. Everything is already hooked up. What do you mean? So if we're not moving well, certainly that's a problem, because the body needs what, as you and I know, proprioceptive stimulation. It actually sends information to the brain. Our movement, my left leg movement, sends a signal up the spinal cord into the brain and says, this unit is okay. And it will prevent people from, you know, dropping into fight or flight, or that there is something wrong with the system and stress chemicals get dropped in. So now I've gone off on a tangent and forgot the letter of your question. Ask again.
It was about why is movement so important to actually getting things like dopamine and serotonin to the brain?
Well, we call it afferent neurology. It actually sends signals to the brain saying that all parts are moving synchronistically. It's such a complex, the mind-body-spirit system. I like to call it the psycho-neuro-immuno-biological-spiritual super system, is all related. So movement helps the rest of the body recognize that it is in good shape and therefore sends the right balance of these brain chemicals that enable us to function properly. But if we're not eating well, none of that matters.
Because
if we're not thinking.
Sorry, you need the food to actually make those good neurotransmitters, right? You can't make serotonin out of chips or ketchup.
I love it. You know, so again, if we're not moving, eating, thinking, feeling, and sleeping well on a regular basis, then something will be a mess. A colleague of mine says, and perhaps you say this too, there are only two things that make us sick or that have us depart from wholeness and wellness, and that's toxicity or deficiency. If there is some toxicity in our environment or our bodies or deficiency, then we're going to be less than well.
And that toxicity could also apply to what we put in our heads as well, as in thoughts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And there is no difference between the negative thoughts in our heads or the processed foods. It all moves into the metabolic machinery and produces those brain chemicals. So do we want good brain chemicals or not so good?
Absolutely. We want the good stuff. Now, let's say if there are some people out there who are listening to this and they're resonating with what you're saying and they're thinking of areas in their life where they need to start making changes for the better. One thing that I believe hugely in is that self-forgiveness and having that is hugely important to allowing you to move forward. But I would say self-forgiveness is letting go of the hope that one day you might be able to make your past better or more pleasurable, which you can't do, obviously. You can't change your past. So how does someone use self-forgiveness, or do you have a different tool that you would recommend people look for to help speed their transformation in this area?
Well, I think that is so important. It's been marginalized as well. You know, we've got this compartmentalized system where you go off to the behavioral health system and it didn't used to have anything to do with physical health. And now we realize, you know, the body is just an extension of the brain. And so whatever the psychological or spiritual process is it's important to take a look at how you've been taking a look at things. And there are a million ways to go, from cognitive to the dialectic behavior therapy to one-on-one psychotherapy to any number of processes where you can continue to look at how your mind has been thinking about things and then offer up different strategies to think about them differently. Talk about rewriting the brain's architecture. We absolutely can. You know what's fascinating to me is I can think back on the way that my brain used to work 20 years ago and why I thought that way. It's the most fascinating thing. And now I don't do that anymore because the payoff is not there. I've got a different set of payoffs that are fantastic and delivered to me what I want, and that is joy, productivity, and peace of mind. But I can go back and re-look at the brain maps of a long time ago. The brain just fascinates me that way. So you need to get in a process that works for you. And it doesn't. The same thing doesn't work for each individual, right?
Mm.
Isn't that what you find?
I do, actually. That's one of the questions that I've got coming up later. You just mentioned a word called dialectic behavior therapy. Is that people just becoming aware of how they talk about things and not saying, oh, I have to go and do this when they're talking about exercise or eating healthily and changing their language to be more positive? Or what is dialectic behavior therapy?
Well, it's under the umbrella of cognitive behavioral therapy. Then instead of going in and sitting down with Dr. Freud and, you know, understanding the depth psychology and what about your mother and father inspired you to do things, you just recognize what is. And then you say, well, there's that. And then you've got a host of strategies that you can do things differently. You're just able to foster the observer in yourself and then say, okay, there is that reaction to this situation. Now I've got these other tools to apply. And it really works beautifully and, you know, for people that perk up to that kind of introspection.
Right. I want to come back to some of these tools in just a little bit. But the other day I was listening to an interview with this, actually it was a podcast, with this guy called Joe Polish, and he's a marketer. And he said something really interesting. Basically, as a marketer, he put his hand up and he said, we have a lot to answer for in terms of addiction, because as a marketer and someone like myself who helped build the advertising industry, we teach people that you've got to have this particular phone, or you have to have a car like this, or your clothes need to look like this, or your watch has to be the size of a grandfather clock if you're going to be successful and happy. So he said, basically what we've done is we've created an industry where we've really fed people's desire to consume more and have more, and we've created addiction. And he said that the exact opposite of addiction is connection. And what marketing has done these days is make people look outside for connection, and then they're just over-consuming. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's beautifully said. It just sort of synopsizes what in the world our culture has done to create this huge epidemic of addiction. So if we're not connected on the inside, then we're not going to connect on the outside. I think you'll agree that the number one common denominator for longevity, in other words, people live the longest, those people who have connection in community, with family, with friendships, those are the most important things. And so that is a hallmark of somebody also who is in long-term addiction recovery. And that's why systems like Alcoholics Anonymous to Weight Watchers, et cetera, work, because there's accountability and deep empathy for other and self.
On that term accountability, that's step number two, if I recall correctly, in your 9-step blueprint. How does someone actually give themselves accountability? And when people are challenging themselves with accountability, how hard do they need to push there?
Well, I think a good way of looking at anything you're doing is, for example, if you're looking to feel better, you got to ask yourselves, how do I look? How do I feel? And how do I function? So if you've got some identified challenges in your life, you need to apply, you know, we need to take a look at how we're taking a look at those challenges by applying something different. And so a good way to do that is to hire a coach or to be accountable to somebody other than, you know, the decisions I've made to get me in this mess in the first place, to get me in this trap in the first place, right? So accountability can show up in lots of different ways, but having an outside influence, another pair of eyes, ears, and heart look at whatever I'm doing. You know, I have a men's team that I've gone to for 20 years. I can see myself in 8 different ways, once a week for 2 hours. I'm accountable to, you know, the daily activities that I do, because I know if I don't, I don't get the payoff I want. So everybody's different, but I think everybody's got to be accountable other than just saying, oh, I got this, I can do this alone. I don't think it's possible.
Well, that's one thing I was going to bring up. Some people genuinely are a lot better at certain things than other people, and some people might be better at creating accountability for themselves versus needing an external source of it. Because I know for some of my clients, just coming in and telling me, hey, I didn't have the best weekend with food, like I would never wag my finger at them and say, that was dumb, or you shouldn't have done that. Just the fact that they say that to someone else is enough for them to not want to do it again. For other people, they may be able to say, right, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to start doing this, or I'm going to change the way that I think about food, or whatever it might be. What might be some indicators that someone actually does have enough internal strength and are good enough at giving themselves accountability that they might be able to try it by themselves? And what would be some signs that someone should look for an accountability partner or something external like a coach?
Well, I think you just sort of nailed it, that person is still coming into you, is still accountable to you. I don't know how it works individually unless somebody has, I've got a process that I do every day called the 5-minute journal, where I sit down and it triggers me or cues me to move into a mental state of gratitude. I know that I have to do that. I'll make lists. That helps me to look at my day so that I don't get off and start multitasking and get out of balance. So I think the individual has to have some kind of process, some kind of structure, whatever that looks per individual. And two, hiring a coach so that you can check in periodically and say, here's how I think I'm doing. How do you think I'm doing? Along with the goals and the structure that whatever change is being inspired. You know, you just have to have a way of looking at it other than the old way of looking at it, which obviously wasn't working.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about feelings for a second, because I've always thought that feelings can be very powerful and they can lead you in the right direction. And feelings also aren't facts. So they're not always true. And a lot of the times we get anxious and nervous about things that we really didn't need to stress about in the first place. But when it comes to changing the way that someone feels, I would really try and, if they were trying to transform their habits or the way that they act, I'd be looking to really align how they feel with what happens when they progress, rather than trying to move someone towards the feeling that they think they'll have when they're perfect with their journey. And you're a big fan of progress before perfection as well. So you don't want people to try and go straight into being perfect with quitting their addiction or their addictive behaviors or bad habits or whatever it might be. So how important do you think it is for people to emotionally attach themselves to the benefits that they get when they make progress rather than pursue this perfection that they can see in their life?
Well, it's a beautiful question and a huge conversation. So I can think to say that we are emotional beings who think. We are not thinking beings who feel. And we've been coached, you know, in our culture to think that emotions are these sort of marginal things that come and go and nobody knows exactly what they're about. I think it's very important to develop emotional intelligence. You know, we've got moral, spiritual, emotional, and intellectual intelligence. And we really honor intellectual intelligence above the other three. So what is it that we can do to realize that these emotions are present in us, to recognize them, and obviously to move on? But if we don't recognize them, they can get repressed and cause all kinds of havoc. Do you know the poet Rumi?
I do know Rumi. He was a Sufi.
Sufi, and he's got a poem called Guest House. Have you ever read it?
I have not read that one, no.
Well, I recommend it to people listening. And, you know, Rumi, whatever it was, 1,200 years ago, said, be hospitable to these feelings, because if you don't, they'll tear the house down, right? And a lot of the behaviors we see around the world are perpetrated by people and even leaders who have these repressed feelings. So, yes, get in a process where you can identify feelings and say, yes, that's a feeling. I don't have to act on it. But if it's unconscious, you know, it can be a problem with getting all of the other things you do want. Emotional intelligence, remarkably important.
Now, what about the kind of mindset or the tool that people can use as their ally to overcome these habits? Because breaking through addiction or the habit, bad habits and impulses and all that kind of stuff is very similar to just getting ahead in life. There's certain things that you could be doing or that you know that you should be doing, which are a little bit of a challenge that you need to start doing more of in order to progress. And for some people, actually for pretty much everyone I've ever met, the way that they go about doing this is different. So I have this one client at the moment who's a golfer, and he used to be like this big shot businessman. I bet he was an accountant, but he'll graph everything. So he'll go and like, he'll make a chart for me on how much he sleeps and how much water he drinks and how many times he does his stretches throughout a day. And he'll come to me and he'll say, look, when I do 32% more stretching, I drop a, you know, I can putt better, but I don't drive as long, but I get straighter. Why does that happen? So he likes tracking stuff and seeing graphs and statistical improvement. But for other people, it's like, hey, I've gone for a walk and I actually feel better. Or, you know, I went out for a walk with my friend and I got that sense of connection instead of us going down and sitting and having coffee, which might be some, a habit that they're trying to break. So how does someone figure out what actually speaks to them, whether it's graphing and tracking themselves or connecting with how they feel when they do something better for themselves, or any of those various strategies? How does someone figure out what's really going to click for them?
Well, it took me a long time to figure out what my wellness protocol is. Don't you have something that you do regularly and you might mix it up during the week, but you're doing it and you're doing it because it works. Do you agree that that's what works for you?
Yep.
So that's what I encourage people to do as it relates to these different parts of our being. We might even call it, there's a famous process here in the United States called the Hoffman Quadrinity process, and it has to do with people integrating their emotional being with their intellectual being, with their spiritual and physical being. And so people can check in every single day and find out, what's going on with my feelings today? What's going on with how my body feels? What's going on with the thoughts I'm thinking? And how is my spirit today, however that feels? And then develop practices for each of those things. I think that we've got to have practice on a daily basis, just in case this is, you know, the last day we're going to live. We've got to have a mind, body, spirit practice going on every day of our lives, because that's just how we showed up as these mind, body, spirit entities. So again, it's different for everybody. And I think that people have to experiment. Repetition is the mother of all invention. They have to find out what works for them and then keep doing it, evolve, add this, remove that. And guess what? Nobody gets out alive, right?
Yeah, that's true. Actually, who was it that said that? Jim Rohn. Is that a Jim Rohn quote that you've just given me there?
I don't know, but I think of Mark Sisson, who says, live long and drop dead, right? Just do these things today and experience the joy, productivity, and peace of mind you can have, because nobody knows how long it's going to last.
Exactly.
And why not be stoked today?
And it's everything that we do is pretty dangerous, because everyone's going to, no one's going to get through life alive. That's
right.
What Jim Rohn would say. Now, basically, yeah. What we're talking about here is figuring out areas of our life where we're doing stuff that isn't quite as healthy or as moving us forward in the way that we would like to, and doing something different. And that requires rewriting the way that the brain goes about it, about its work, and setting new patterns for ourselves and having new software. Now, are there any mental activities that you can give people that will help them change the way that they think or change the way that they act or change the software that their computer runs on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think these days it is much more accessible. You know, you can go to Headspace, which is an application to learn to meditate, to learn to quiet your mind, and to learn to move around different aspects of your mind to rewire these things. What do you want? Do you want more graciousness, gratitude, generosity? Do you want to deal with your pregnancy? Do you want to deal with, you know, stress in your life? So I think meditation is a wonderful way to go around that. There are, I think that, you know, a men's or a women's group where you can go in and sort of take a look at the way that your mind works is another good way of looking at things. And lots of different processes that you have to get comfortable with, because we're not used to fostering the observer in our lives. We're more used to just sort of reacting to what's out there. What do you do, Dave, with respect to training your brain?
Well, I really try extremely hard, and I'm very successful at it, actually, now that I think about it, to have a little bit of quiet time at the start of every single day to figure out what it is that I actually want out of that day, what it is that I actually really need to do, and how I want to feel doing all that kind of stuff. So I try really hard not to get distracted by things that I could be doing that aren't as kind of... There was a good story that I heard last night. I was watching this guy, and he was talking about if you fell off a cruise ship, there's two things that you need to do. You need to tread water so you don't drown, and you need to swim forward. And he said you need to spend as much time throughout your day swimming forward rather than just treading water and doing things that are going to progress you without drowning. And so I always think about, what am I going to do today that's going to be like swimming forward rather than getting bogged down with treading water all the time and just trying to keep myself afloat? That's my mindset, well, is trying to figure out what to do in that area.
I love that. And so you have a practice, a mindfulness practice, a breath practice, whatever it is, to pause and really kind of reflect upon how your day is going to unfold from visualization, et cetera. And there are a million ways to do that. And you can start by just taking a couple of minutes every day, sitting and noticing how your body's feeling, what emotions you're having, how the thoughts are passing through your mind, and how your spirit feels or your soul feels, if indeed that is part of your understanding or your worldview. It's important for me, and I think for a lot of people, but maybe not others. So yes, a practice, very important. When I work with clients, we develop those practices that are fine-tuned for, as I say, what people will do, because if I try to project something onto somebody that they're not interested in, as you know, it doesn't work.
Mm, absolutely. Now, perhaps the last question for you, and I think this one is a big one too. What about the language that we use when we're talking about the things that we do in our life? And I really think this does change people. I have a friend who, she used to talk about her mortgage, and she'd say, oh, I have to pay it off, and I have to pay it off. But then she swapped and she started saying, I'm buying more house, I'm buying more house, I'm buying more house. And every time I pay off this mortgage, instead of me paying a bill, it's like I'm getting a little bit more of my house. So what areas do you think people could really improve in with regards to that, and how, what things should they be keeping an eye out for with regards to the language that we use when we talk to ourselves that could be problematic?
Well, I love the expression that I never metaphor I didn't like, which, and I love your stories because they conjure up all kinds of imagery. So that's the way the brain works, and that's how we learn to be human beings. As little babies, we started to make up stories associated with an image or a ball or a structure in front of us. And so we've got these brain maps that identify with how things kind of manifest during the day. And I think that's right. If we stay present tense, and if we are making pictures and imagining what we want, instead of going into the negativity of it, the brain will indeed start to develop. Wayne Dyer used to say, or somebody like that, God bless his soul, he was a neat guy, that if we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. And so very definitely, language is absolutely powerful in that. Positive psychology has come forward. Everybody's excited about it because it's the way the brain works and we can get what we want.
So what would be some things that you think people should avoid saying? Like, for one would be, I have to go to the gym, or I have to go and do my exercise, or something like that. For me, I think when people say I have to go and do something like that, that's a really big warning sign, because you're actually getting something out of doing that exercise. It's something that you do to get a benefit rather than you have to go and do it. Like, you have to go and pay taxes. You don't have to go to the gym. You get to go to the gym. So what other thoughts or sayings that people commonly use would you consider to be a red flag there?
Well, I think that's right. You know, might just switch out a word and saying, I'm choosing to go to the gym because I've created this this agreement with this man, David White, and I'm going to be accountable to that because he's going to help me get what I want, and that is more joy, productivity, and peace of mind. And so I'm choosing to go to the gym today. So whatever it takes to move out of the negative or a pejorative into something that gets you what you want, you can think about it for a while. Won't you agree that you can sit back and think what it would be like to have what you want, and all of a sudden your entire constitution of your body changes and your mind changes. Choosing instead of having to makes a huge difference.
A lot less of a burden to carry around every day as well. When you do right. things that you choose to do every day rather than all these things that you think you have to.
Well, I go to the gym every day more for a headspace thing, but I get absolutely as high as a kite every single day, coupled with the movement I do and the music I listen to, and high in a very natural way, in a nice way. But and I hear people talking about not wanting to do that. And I think, boy, I really am lucky that way because it's something that I choose to do that really is a big part of my life.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Bell. This has been hugely insightful. And I honestly think everyone, even if they don't have any impulses or addictions or bad behavior, should be listening to this kind of stuff, because I really don't think you can ever get good enough at really addressing the way that you behave and act. And I don't want to say control again, but really being the master of that rather than having it dictated to you. So thank you so much for coming and sharing your wisdom there.
Thank you, Dave. And I think that's why we're here. This exploration, this schoolhouse, is to learn these things. I don't know exactly for what higher reason, but I'm convinced that that's why we're here, to do exactly what you're doing. Thank you for the good work you're doing in the world.
Thank you. And your website for everyone who's listening is recoveryhealthcare.me. And your podcast, which you haven't done for a while, was called Sober Conversations. You had George Bryan on there. He was on this show a couple months ago. What a lovely man he is.
Isn't he something? And so, yes, there was a little hiatus. We plan to get it much more active in the future. But thank you for saying that. Sober Conversations at iTunes.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant little podcast.
And your podcast is fantastic. I can't wait to move through more of it. There is a wealth of knowledge there. And thank you again for taking the time to talk to these world-class people.
You're a champion. Thanks for joining me, Herbie. I'll chat to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Authentic Wellness Radio.